This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Giovanni Donato. We're going to be discussing the mechanisms of social status. Giovanni, it's great having you back on the show.
Yeah, nice to be back. Thank you.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Sam Kevorkian.
Hey, nice to be back.
Giovanni, you did a whole series on the topic of social status. The first one is the mechanisms of social status. And you make the point that our society focuses more on economics, but neglects the issue of social status.
I felt that was a subject worth addressing because it seems to have been neglected as a motive force in describing the way civilization works. And in my view, that sort of stems from the imperialistic Enlightenment description of reality. They don't like to deal with things that are not readily tangible or testable.
Also, with economics, you have actual statistics of economic status, things like per capita income, income inequality, that can be mapped in a map in data, but social status is more difficult for sociologists to keep tabs of. But do you think that's the key factor, or do you think there's actual suppression of the topic?
I feel like the people who would have started the Enlightenment would have been a bit more reasonable on this, but it sort of went down a slippery slope so that by the time you get to utilitarianism in the 19th century, they're basically trying to define human pleasure or pain as highest good by looking at spreadsheets. And that kind of mindset is the cause of untold evils of modernism.
So you make the point in your article that social status is necessary in a pre-modern society to basically survive. And if someone has a low social status, they're pretty much an outcast from their tribe, and that affects their rate of survival. But we're living in today's modern society and increasingly into a post-scarcity society. The mechanisms of social status work differently.
Well, post-scarcity or not, status is relative and will always be there. If you have $1 million, but everyone else has $2 million, you'll feel like a loser. You know, it's what they they call keeping up with the Joneses.
Well,
so that's one of the things a post-scarcity, post-modern society has to deal with is how do you keep status spirals under control?
There's a whole cliche that you shouldn't feel bad about yourself because there's people starving in the other parts of the world. And that's true. But people base their identity on how their status is relative to the people around them.
Yep, which makes that objection irrelevant. That's why it's a cliche that nobody pays attention to. They aren't competing with people in Ethiopia or wherever the starving people are in that tired aphorism.
And you make the point that people can sort of have their own personal basic needs cared for, but the real reason that people are willing to work 40 plus hour work weeks and basically wasting their lives doing things they hate is to have these forms of status to gain basic respectability.
Yeah, I mean, I can't explain it any other way how people get that far invested in a career where the day they stop it after decades, nobody will care. They're there because their friends and family, everybody they know would look down on them for not having a job, and furthermore, for not having a real job, and they'd probably be unable to get married or have a family, not even so much because of financial reasons, but because of status reasons. I mean, clearly we see the underclass finds a way to feed children, but the middle classes still insist they can't afford a child, not so much because the child would literally starve, but because they've assessed that they cannot, or they're insecure and that they can provide that child with a status appropriate lifestyle.
It's also, there is an issue of hypergamy where women refuse to date or marry down. And in the middle class, there are more female earners. In the upper middle class now, like in the millennial generation, there are more female earners than there are male earners, in that like females earn more than men on average in the millennial generation among those who have jobs.
You're touching on a very a common objection to heavy female involvement in the workplace. Because when a man succeeds, the common point is in the red pill sphere is that when a man succeeds at a career and he makes it, then he's going to happily marry down to the secretary or whoever else is around him. Meanwhile, a female that reaches the same level of achievement is going to look for somebody even higher than her. And oftentimes she's going to be doing that by the time she's establishing herself in career success, often by age 30 or so, when her sexual market value isn't what it used to be, and she expects greater dividends than she would have a decade earlier. So the unrealistic expectations and the perpetual attempt to climb the ladder can lead to sexual market disaster and a collapse in fertility.
And you also did a whole series on that topic as well?
Yeah. I think it's, for the dissident sphere, it's a really old topic to discuss the effect of dysgenics when middle-class people have extremely low fertility while the underclasses who can take advantage of state support are thriving, or at least they're doing better or closer to replacement.
And some people have promoted things like pronatalist economic policies, and that may have some effect. Now, but I think a lot of it is tied in with status, whether exactly. A lot of it has to do with whether having a family is a status symbol or not.
You just touched on a huge part of the reason why I felt compelled to write on status. When I go on dissident and red pill forums, everyone says, hey, we need to give these financial incentives, but that's not the problem. The core problem is status. For these career climbers, having children is viewed as low status, and you can give them as much money as you want. They'll just take more vacations to Iceland.
You're talking about those economic proposals, like someone, I think even Trump for a while was talking about child care tax credits. Your point is that that's not that effective because the mechanisms of status are so much more powerful than that.
Yeah, if the underclass people can feed their children, the middle class people can do it several times over if they wanted to, but they don't want to because they feel as though they have to pay for college and all this other stuff. And the bottom line in modern society is children are a net drain for anybody. They're not free farm labor or a 401k policy like they used to be. And that's a core problem any modern post-scarcity society is going to have to deal with.
Well, I think for the ultra-wealthy, for some people, for having like 3 to 4 kids is a status symbol. And you see that with, Trump's probably the best example of that. And you see it with some celebrities, too, because it's like saying, like, I have unlimited wealth, so I can't afford like 4 kids. It's more in the middle class where having a career is put, it's more in the upper middle class where that's the case.
Unfortunately, billionaires aren't really a significant demographic. There's few enough of them, it just doesn't matter. And we've discussed before how people earning 6 figures in the Silicon Valley still feel they can't afford children. And there's even sort of an idea that it's low status and it will inhibit their career climbing.
Like, that whole thing about, like, having children inhibits your career, that's true for women, not so true with men. And as far as like your dreams and your goals, I think generally having any type of romantic involvement with a woman would inhibit that because women naturally want to take up your time. But in this culture, men still feel the need to want to be romantic involved with women because aside from the biological imperative, the reproductive imperative, it's sort of like you're seen as a loser if you don't have a girlfriend, if you don't get laid.
Having a girlfriend is an important part of the status signaling, I think.
Yeah.
Which I feel like people are caring more about how their girlfriend is perceived, like class-wise, looks-wise, and they're not like measuring her up for future children to the same extent they would have. I feel like the motivations are somewhat different in that it fits into their status-driving mentality.
Well, I've even noticed this on a lot of those red pill sites. A lot of the stuff, it's not so much, it's their political, they claim to be dissidents, but what's ironic is everything about them is these guys online writing in forums trying to prove their social status to other strangers online.
Oh, yeah, and also, like, if you're hiding behind a username and avatar, you could say whatever the hell you want. So, like, how the hell are we supposed to know that they're not lying about how they got laid with 500 women?
I never take anything a man says about sexual conquests without verification at face value. Every man brags about that.
You did write that article, The Macroeconomics of Beauty. Was this sort of a follow-up to the social status series?
Yeah, I think one of the things that keeps men on that status treadmill is when they feel they have a realistic chance of getting having a long-term attachment to a reasonably attractive female. I feel like a lot of men are giving up on the feeling that they have a realistic chance of having status enough to get together with a reasonably attractive woman, feeling like they're left with the leftovers of unattractive or obese women. And that's why we see the growth of internet movements like MGTOW, men going their own way, or just dropping out Japanese style in general. It's so much easier to just play computer games and wank off to porn.
Yeah, and also, like, the advancement of male sex toys, it's, like, a lot of the times, like, there's, like, in the near future, if not already, like, forget about sex robots. Like, once sex robots come along, it'll be game over, but even before that, there'll be, like, sex machines that will do a man better than a real woman can.
Well, but I think all that stuff is going to happen in the future, and it will be widely used, like pornography, but the key thing is that's taken into account. There's still going to be this need for social status, and we could see this post-scarcity economy where, say, everyone has a basic income, and their basic needs are taken care of. But I think if that's the case, then social status will be even more important than it is now.
Yeah, well, I think Rob's a good point there. Because if let's say everyone has a sex robot at home, just like everyone now has a computer at home with porn, that'll be seen as low status. And having a real-life girlfriend might ironically be even higher in status than it is now.
Yeah. Or it may be higher in status if you have a very realistic sex robot that's indistinguishable from a real woman that costs like $200,000 or $1 million.
I guess we already have porn where men can pretend they're having sex with women that are far more attractive than they would ever realistically be with in real life. But nobody really considers that to be an accomplishment. Social status comes from the approval of other people right there in meat space.
How much of a role do you think demographics play? Because in general, as the population is aging and the demographic makeup is changing, there is a smaller pool of young white women. So, and young white women are generally the most sought after. So that's, how much of a role does demographics play?
I mean, I've seen arguments that white women are the most attractive on average. There may be something to that, but I don't know if it has that much of an impact. I mean, I suppose, like, if, like, black women were a lot more numerous, I mean, because of their higher than average rates of obesity, that might play a role. But I think they are, white women are sought after because of status. Like, say a man is with a white man is with an Asian woman that seems, that's often belittled as going for lower status or not being high status enough to get a white woman. I think it has more to do with status than any special magic or intrinsic properties that white women have.
You wrote about a social status, and I think it was about high school, and the reference to that article was that there was some Republican pundit, I forget his name, for National Review. He was the same one who made that comment that the white working class deserves to die. And he made, it was in reference to the Charlottesville event.
Oh God, it seems like articles like that come out every week now. Like that Ta-Nehisi Coates guy came out with something similar just a couple days ago. That insanity is getting pretty incredible. But come to think of it, with the white women, I seem to remember that was sort of a main platform point for the white nationalist 1.0 types, that they had to save white women or get with white women. And that was a political non-starter with a lot of guys who just want status and to get laid.
And the point of that article was that our whole society as a whole, including adult society, even like way into middle age, is still kind of stuck in this high school narrative, and affects not just social status, and affects the corporate world as well.
Yeah, I think it sets us up to be for the sort of office politics culture for the rest of our lives, where popularity and being able to please people matters more than competence. The class president or the quarterback is higher status than being people who are merely useful.
You made an interesting comment about Trump, and putting aside Trump's policies, I think the reason a lot of people hate Trump is kind of, you were talking about what he symbolizes. Like he symbolizes like the worst caricature from high school.
Yeah, we can pretty much even forget the discussion of Trump's policies. I mean, nobody really talks about his policies to the extent he has them or even discusses him rationally, especially those who disapprove. I mean, all they have to say is what a bully, what a narcissist, what an evil man, what a Hitler. I mean, none of it makes sense from a rational perspective where you're Trump. Just criticizing a politician. There's something, some kind of emotional knee-jerk going on there that goes far deeper.
It's about Trump's personality type. One example of that is like all his adversaries are always like, he calls them losers.
Yeah, I mean, he reminds people of sort of that Biff Tannen archetype.
Oh, exactly, yeah.
Back to the Future. And he represents sort of a working class bully figure who pounds down the geeky middle class kids in high school, and from entertainment and from their real life experiences, that's an archetype they still resent going into adulthood.
I think it's mostly you're saying it's more upper middle class kind of nerdy men more really despise him. But what is
and the core middle class?
Yeah, the middle class too, but for some reason the working class, that personality type appeals to them.
Because that quarterback, that big strong quarterback usually is like a middle class, I mean a working class archetype. And the narrative that the middle to upper class prefer is that, haha, I'm going to go be this computer programmer and Biff gets to bag groceries for the rest of his life. But in reality, a popular quarterback has succeeded in that high school society, and he has the social skills to get in the right frat and meet alums. And more surprisingly often, he's going to end up the boss of these people who thought they were going to be happily ever after as computer programmers, and that rankles them to no end.
Do you see the way corporations function as mirroring high school?
Yeah, somebody in my comments pointed out that high school is just an artificial environment, and once you move on from that, it's all gone. But the point that I made to that is that any workplace is also a very highly artificial environment that isn't that different than high school. And high school sort of sorts out leadership people from grinders who do their bidding.
And that kind of goes back to the whole concept that, you know, the blogger line of the blogosphere likes to talk about, he calls it value transference.
Yep, that's an old topic of his.
Can you explain that?
This is something I think American culture in general and in high school encourages, is that creating real value is almost looked down on. Like being a smooth talker and getting people to donate to your hedge fund, which not only doesn't create value, but might actually hurt people. It's almost seen with some level of admiration by people.
Yes, I totally agree. Like, for example, if somebody's a loser and he can't get with a girl and he compensates for that by creating an AI that's very close to the real thing, he's still seen as a loser, even though he's done more to help society than somebody who's just like, getting laid with a lot of different women, who's just like a DJ at a club and pretty much has done nothing to really help society.
Yeah, I think I pointed this out in my article, that high school sort of feeds into this royal court culture where it's more about your connections and who you're able to please and get in good standing with than what value you can offer. And if you're one of the people actually working hard, it means you did something wrong and weren't smart enough. And it applies to jobs, women, leadership, pretty much everything in our society.
And then there's this whole narrative that's put out, is you're basically, your success in society is based on pretty much how hard you work, and also to a degree your intelligence level. So there's a notion if you work hard and are intelligent that you're going to succeed. And conservatives especially like to put this out, but that doesn't take into account the social status.
Yeah, social skills really are the skill that rules them all. Like, what you can do is secondary to who likes you. And to some extent, that's just plain human nature in all times and places. But a late stage sort of decadent society actually one doubles down and glorifies that.
And social status has always been around, but the mechanisms have changed. So in the pre-Enlightenment time, there was a sort of caste system of the aristocracy, going down the priest caste and then the peasants, and that's more how social status functioned. So social status is always going to be around, it's just the mechanisms have changed. Yes. Your point is that manipulating the status system is far more effective than direct coercion. So basically taking a person and demoting their social status is more effective than actually persecuting them through actual, like trying to have someone arrested or something like that.
Yeah, that's a good thing to bring up. But you were discussing how there was an aristocracy and priesthood before the Enlightenment that was in charge. Now, I was saying how this whole problem sort of gradually came from the Enlightenment. What we really have to understand about the Enlightenment, it was a revolt of those merchant classes against the priests and aristocracy, and they eventually won. So as far as everything coming down to spreadsheets and money and economics and the customer always being right, being agreeable and pleasing people, we really need to understand that comes from the values of the merchant caste becoming the highest status.
You also talk about the case with James Damore from Google, and you're saying now, even though he lost his job, that as a celebrity, his social status has increased.
Right. As I point out in my article, that as the election of Trump shows, they tried to shut him down just by using money, but money is almost just a measure of status. I mean, you get money for being, when you have a dollar in your hand, society is telling you, you're that valuable to us, keep going. So if they take away, if they make someone like Damore high status by putting him in national headlines, it doesn't matter that he's not bringing in his regular $300,000 a year paychecks anymore. He'll get that back and more by being higher status than he used to be. It just naturally follows. It's sort of like, please don't throw me in the briar patch. They think they're punishing him, and they're too stupid to realize how counterproductive that's going to be for them. It really is the actions of a late-stage decadent elite.
We did this whole series on the post-scarcity economy, and in this kind of future society where all the jobs are automated and people have a basic income, do you think that will make social status even more important because the traditional career path will be less accessible?
Yes, because status is relative. If you even the playing field in some way, people will always find other ways to compete for status. And even just looking at markets, like look at the way prices of college degrees inflated when pretty much everyone is guaranteed a college loan. The same exact thing happens on status markets. When everybody has this basic income as a baseline, you got to distinguish yourself and get ahead in some other way. The price of status competition has risen.
It's also a way to attack one's political opponents. In the high school article, you talked about that guy from the National Review who made that comment. Forget specifically what he said, but there was another...
He suggested that the guys at Charlottesville aren't the type to be taking home the prom queen.
Oh, yeah, because that reminds me. I'm not sure. I think it was someone else, but there was this other guy who wrote for National... I think he wrote for National Review or Red State or one of those conservative sites. He said... Trump supporters are childless single men who jerk off to anime and they don't matter in the course of history. And that's a common political tactic, is to marginalize your political adversaries as having low social status.
Yep. Nobody wants to follow losers. And the Charlottesville guys likewise were showing up in preppy outfits, so the khakis and polo shirts, to try to diffuse the low status attacks. So you see a strategy and counter strategy there.
And some people also join dissident movements because it carries a high status, because being a political dissident can be seen as being sexy.
Yeah, when a dissident movement really starts to catch on, you know the established status system is really going downhill. When it doesn't suck all the oxygen out and has space for an actual challenger to function in. And a lot of that, you mentioned earlier about how taking away people's status is a key form of social control. And it is. But now we've reached a point where they can kick guys like James Damore out and it doesn't even hurt him anymore. That's when you'll see more and more people leave their side to look for status elsewhere. I don't think they or anyone realizes yet just how damaging that is to their prestige.
And also with the way the internet functions today, 20 years ago, you used to have to find social status within mainstream society. But now with all these online subcultures, from politics to music subcultures, people find their own unique niche, and then they find social status within that niche.
It honestly kind of escapes me why corrupt nepotistic elites didn't shut down or severely limit the internet a long time ago, when they still could have. Probably because they weren't united and were greedy to exploit all the profit potential of the internet, not realizing how having it loosely regulated would backfire on them. Giving dissidents that space to operate in may prove fatal to them, that they've gone tremendously downhill. I remember being a kid with the 90s and in the 90s, and it seemed like the local newspaper and the nightly news was a cultural institution, and now everyone laughs at it.
I just want to make a comment that you're absolutely right that it's easy to find niches on the internet where you could achieve social status that you can't in your high school or in the workplace or within mainstream society. And I think that's one of the reasons why I think the dissident movements will, in the end, become more popular and overcome mainstream culture. Because if you look at all of the stuff that the mainstream is into, like anybody with a semi-critical eye would see it as a joke, like the type of music they listen to, the type of movies they like, you know.
Well, to look at a good example of the internet giving alternate status, just look at us. I mean, would you be able to convince a local radio station to give you a radio show back in the pre-internet era? Or would I be able to write articles that get read by thousands of people?
I've been on AM radio a while back.
But would this have been like a mainstream network that lots of people would have been listening to on their cars? I still feel like you're reaching a hugely greater audience than you would have been able to in that pre-internet era.
You wrote an article, The Alt Sphere Should Embrace Culture and Aesthetics. I hear a lot of people, and you point this out, they're saying everyone has to get into STEM and trades, and people who make movies and put out art, that's very effective, but it's always been the case, just on the right wing. I don't know how long it's been. I'd say at least since the 1950s, the right wing has always been very kind of like hostile towards culture. I mean, they're kind of hypocritical in a sense, because they'll bemoan that the left has a monopoly on Hollywood and culture, but at the same time, they kind of will say, oh, go get a real job. Cultural stuff does not have value.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of that, what these conservative people is doing is they're, or those right wingers, is they're reacting to what they see as the decadent urban culture. But that's where the culture and the creativity is coming from. And if they distance themselves from that, rather than taking those urban cultural production centers back and dominating them under their own power, they're basically surrendering the field of battle.
Yeah, I think people who talk about moving out to the middle of nowhere, I think that's very kind of defeatist. I think people should be in cultural centers and actively engaged.
I think one of the big changes that the alt-right and dissidents have proposed is to stop retreating to the middle of nowhere, building a bunker with canned food, waiting for the nuclear winter to clear things out. And they dismiss that as being pathetic and cuckish, and they're right. The real thing to do is to try to win the debate in every medium it takes place in, and not to ignore the cultural side either, and to go on the attack and really try to win.
But I've noticed with different blogs, take a blog like Brandon Adamson's blog, altleft.com. He focuses a lot on culture. I focus a lot on culture. But our blogs, we have our own niche, but we're kind of put to the side. Like, I noticed the core dissident blogs, like, all they talk about is politics nonstop. Or they talk about memes, which are, memes are effective, but there's not as much serious talk about culture.
I feel like the memes are like a form of I don't know, shall we say street art have really
street art. So they are an important part of culture.
It's important, but they need more than
also,
that.
You need things like, you need visual arts like paintings, you need music, you need architecture, you need all of that.
Well, I can't consider myself a core alt, right? I've called myself alt center or neo tribalist, any number of things, but I look on them with friendly eyes, and I think that's the next step I would advise them to take.
Yes. I just continue on that point. I was on the Christian hangout with Reactionary Ian, and I was talking about how, like, maybe some of us should should choose the artistic route over, like, the whole careerist family, traditional route. And, like, I was I got ganged up on because, like, from the way they see it is, like, they think that everybody must, like, this is the common problem with most people in the alt-right in traditionalist circles, is that they...
Is Reactionary Ian alt-right or more a Christian traditionalist?
Both.
I think I've seen that guy. Isn't he on Twitter?
Yeah, he's known.
He seems to focus on flame wars.
Yeah, well, continuing on that point, it just seems that, like, there's this disdain for art within the church, and it's kind of hard for a lot of Christian artists because they have so much artistic limitations compared to secular artists, because, you know, they can't really go too far off the reservation or else it's degenerate. And also, like, there's so much pressure for you to become a successful corporate cog so you could be able to marry a woman and raise a nice middle-class Christian family. And it's not just generally the Christian culture and the conservative culture overlap. So a lot of the things that, because for most part, the conservative culture is the Christian culture.
I was going to say the same trend has happened with Christianity as conservatism, which you say the overlap, because in Europe, the Catholic Church sponsored a lot of cathedrals, and they would hire different artists. But if you look at the modern day American Christianity, especially like the Protestants and especially evangelical Christians, they have no interest in aesthetics whatsoever. A lot of these mega churches all practically resemble like Walmarts.
Yeah, that's true. It's also because, like, the Protestants, they come from a Calvinist lineage, so they tend to be iconoclastic. They see, extravagant art as a form of idolatry.
But, I don't know, Muslims are also iconoclastic as far as depicting people, and they still have brilliant artwork.
But yeah, it's...
I would point out that that a lot of these alt-right people are rejecting, what I see them doing is they're rejecting the Spartan Calvinistic Protestant aesthetic, and they're looking back to like Catholic and Renaissance and even Greco-Roman inspirations for aesthetics, and I think that's a positive step and in the right direction. The trouble is because of that rigid right-wing personality type, they're trying to dredge up and resurrect the old. Take Wrath of Non. He's one of my favorite Twitter channels, but he seems to have the idea that we can bring back these medieval villages.
I notice a lot of them will post art, like they'll post images of medieval art, and then, but they're not so much creating new artwork. Like they'll post an image of a Renaissance painting or an image of a cathedral on Twitter.
Yeah, so I think they've gone the... It's a positive that they've rejected modern, minimalist, non-representational art and Spartan Protestantism, and they're looking for something that's beautiful. I mean, that's a good step right there. But what they need to do instead of let's bring this stuff back is like instead of say here's this great art we used to have, but now let's make something new that reflects the spirit of the modern age in a positive, life-affirming way. I haven't seen them get to that point yet, and that's what I would encourage them to do.
And that's how movements start, because a movement, I wouldn't say a movement, I'd say a culture. A culture encompasses a lot of different things. Music, art, architecture, and political ideology overlaps with that. But you need a whole entire holistic approach.
Yeah, and it's also the within, traditionally within Protestantism, there's a kind of like they, like the celibate path is kind of looked down upon because... I guess because traditionally, like Catholic priests who were celibate were required to be celibate. I guess many of them were corrupt. They weren't really celibate. They were seeing prostitutes or whatever. So they assume that everybody who's not married is some type of like bad character. So like there's an emphasis on being married and working to provide for a family, and also ties into like the whole idle time is a devil's playground thing, and the Protestant work ethic. All those things are tied together, where there's an emphasis on work and providing for a family that pretty much represents like the main stream of American conservatism, and it also ties in to American culture, secular culture, where there is a high status associated with getting a wife or a girlfriend and having a nice job, and people who are celibate are generally looked down upon.
So you're saying in both Christian Protestant society and secular society?
Yeah, I mean, well, Christian Protestant society is more accepting of celibacy than secular society is generally, but there is the expectation that even though you're expected to be celibate in singleness, like there's an expectation that you're going to get a good job in order to get a wife, in order to have a family.
One of the main things to take away from Protestantism, it's a revolt to what would have been a lot of real excesses of the Catholic Church at the time. So in some cases, they took away all this ceremony and decoration and sacred and holy orders. But they made a huge mistake in priding themselves on not replacing it with a new aesthetic. The Protestant sort of Spartanness and lack of ornateness and decoration is kind of an example of what an alt-right culture does not want to become.
Yeah, in my opinion. I think in a sense is kind of a rebellion against that, but especially the American form of Protestantism. I mean, the Church of England has some pretty... The Church of England is closer to Catholicism, but the American Christianity, going from the Puritans to the modern-day evangelicals, as I pointed out, they have no regards for aesthetics whatsoever. I think another thing about Protestant religion and influence in America and the Protestant work ethic and Calvinism is I think Calvinism plays a role in social status, because the Calvinist teaching is your status in society is predetermined. How much of an influence do you see Calvinism playing?
I don't think Calvinism can be underrated as an influence over American society. It definitely informs that puritanical worldview that Americans seem so attracted to. The whole idea being that we're already predestined to go to heaven or hell already from the day of our birth, but we don't know till we're dead. So our whole lives are spent acting our station as one of the elect, to try to be one of the elect and be elected and move on to heaven.
Yeah, and it's also, I have a lot of experience with Calvinist theology, going to Calvinist churches. It's sort of like this emphasis within Calvinism for a work ethic is that you have to work hard and be a provider and have good works in order to have assurance that you're one of the elect, or else if you don't work hard and you don't produce good works, your assurance suffers. So it could have a severe psychological effect on the believer. And I've seen it happen with many people who've gotten into Calvinism.
I think a good example of the pervasiveness of that Calvinistic attitude is how it's even spread into certain segments of the counterculture. One of my favorite examples being how a lot of like libertarian type red pill sites focus on this R versus K selection concept, which I've critiqued as basically being a Darwinian Calvinism. The thesis that some people are born these rabbits that have no loyalty and they backstab people of virtue, and then there's the wolves that are virtuous and plan for the future and are good people, and it's genetically predestined.
So you're saying as far as human biodiversity goes, obviously genetics are a huge factor, but you're saying a lot of people on the far right, they say that it's everything, and they neglect the role that culture plays.
Right. Well, I'm sure we're going to find that personality types matter hugely, and in the fracture of culture that we see coming, enabled in large part by the internet, I believe those fractures will be along the lines of personality types, which also will happen to coincide with political views and lifestyle choices.
You wrote this article, The Social Cosmology, and you talk about this kind of new form of religion as a form of designating a social status, and these secular saints.
I've focused on aesthetics because I don't think a lot of people who are ideal, it's partly enabled by the Enlightenment mindset, which is very literal minded, relentlessly literal minded, and all about empirical observation, as well as status, they miss out on the importance of symbols and the conflicts and battles in between symbols and how that affects everyone's social and collective consciousness.
Was your point like, that modern society like, functions as a new religion with these secular saints?
Right. Like, look at the way they perceive, like, the Malala Yousafzai lady. It's very much like people would have acted towards a Catholic saint or martyr, or towards Emmett Till, or how they were acting towards Trayvon, or they find these people that they designate martyrs who ideally fill that role for various reasons, often related to diversity points, just like any other religion.
Yeah, I think some people, they generally believe they're doing the right altruistic thing, and then for some people it's just a way to virtue signal their social status.
I doubt probably very few people are consciously saying, hey, I'm virtue signaling, as they virtue signal. It's basically just part of their innate strategy in life and part of their psyche. They're not really thinking it out.
We are getting close to the end of the show. Is there anything else you'd like to add about the topics of social status and how it's structured in our society?
We've reached dissidents as a counterculture have reached a critical point, where with Charlottesville, they're starting to move into the physical world and be a part of society. Some surveys are indicating something like 10% of people actually sympathize with the alt-right now. So
from this point on,
this point on, the focus is going to be less in like bashing blue-haired feminists and actually describing and solidifying what the alt-right is and what its aesthetic is and how it's going to present itself to the rest of society is. Those are going to be huge debates going on right now. Just a couple hours before our show, there was a huge debate on Nazi symbols in the alt-right, accompanied with a huge fight on Gab. It was been a big event in the dissident sphere. And there will be more fights like that as the hierarchy is worked out and the different groups solidify and arrive at who does what and who occupies which sphere. That's going to be a main focus from now on.
Since we talked about the old center last time, do you have any more comments on that? I read this article. It was in regards to Cynthia McKinney that said that the alt-left and the alt-right should merge together. Was it McKinney who said that, or one of her supporters?
Now, what would be interesting to know is what she meant by alt-left. The meaning of that has drifted since Trump made his comment on the alt, compared the Antifas with alt-left, or equated them with alt-left following Charlottesville, where before that, the term was used in dissident spheres to mean basically red-pilled Bernie bros.
Yeah, so, I think it's possibly that she was referring to the first group, just the generic kind of radical left.
Now, as for an alt-center, I've equated myself, is that it takes a lot of the tribalism and so on of the alt-right, but then incorporates a lot of the cooperation and redistribution that would be considered leftist when they're given out to everyone. But within a tribal context, I'm not sure you can really consider that left anymore. So I think the idea of alt-center is inextricably linked to the sort of new tribalism that's being fueled by the internet.
Yeah, I do think another part of the alt-center is not just the economics issue, but putting a lot of emphasis on culture, because blogs like my blog and Brandon Adamson's blogs do put a strong emphasis on culture. And I think that has to be, that's a key characteristic, because the radical right tends to neglect culture.
I guess that's another good point. It sort of bridges the gap between personality types that tend to be on the political spectrum and tries to adopt the best ideas of each. Maybe in that way, it could actually be said to be centrist.
You did post an article a while back about what your ideal aesthetic would look like. Can you go over that kind of briefly? We did talk about that before, but can talk about it again.
Interestingly, I've seen like this retro techno aesthetic start to rise. And a commenter on Twitter even linked to this someone's Tumblr that had an aesthetic like that, like spaceships, this whole idea of like spaceships and palaces.
You know, are you like talking about version. More kind of like David Lynch's Dune, or more the retro wave type genre?
No, like I even saw this one image that was going around on neo-reactionary Twitter that shows like a royal family in a palace watching as a huge battle cruiser takes off. There's a lot of Dune and that kind of aesthetic, and
I think your article was sort of based on Dune.
And I was discussing this on Twitter, where I think my focus is on like a techno minimalism, where you're only using high energy solutions where it's really most effective, and you're being very economical in how you use technology, which would even lead to stuff like Antarctic colonies and stuff over time, as making as perfecting and making current technologies more efficient becomes even bigger than making new technologies.
And as far as the whole neo-tribalism angle goes, I don't think going the whole kind of Luddite national anarchist way, I don't really see that as a pathway forward. I see that more as the people who just want to retreat out into the wilderness. I think it will be necessary for there to be these successful urban diaspora groups.
Yeah, they need to take the culture, the cities, everything back, not leave any battlefields alone, engage them everywhere.
And so basically carve out neighborhoods, like say you have a Chinatown or something sort of on that model, but in the key urban areas of like New York, San Francisco, and LA.
Yeah, other groups do it, always have done.
You've touched on a good point there, Rob, how like these groups that have a lot of influence are the ones that tend to carve out their part of a urban center as opposed to, you know, just moving in the middle of the country and, you know, the woods or whatever, withdrawing from society.
And at some point, you have to form a counterculture that or movement of something, that power center that can directly challenge the powers you're against, or else you eventually will be tracked down and co-opted, and you will lose.
Since we were talking about religion, do you think the trend towards secularization is that a lot of young people see religion as having a low social status, so they become secular for that reason?
Yes, that the status plays a role into it, but I think that status association even forms because it is really hard with all the in an information age to really reconcile oneself with the faith-based beliefs that religion traditionally demands. I think that was a lot more viable in societies where most people weren't literate.
Yeah, well, there is some truth to that because when you're exposed to a lot of different information and your church doesn't have the answers, that could really hurt your faith. Especially when it comes to evolution.
I feel like those are adapted to a different kind of society, and religion's never going to go away. It'll always be there. But what I've noticed is it seems in modern times to thrive generally like a literal faith-based religion, not just like saying I go to church in generally lower IQ populations where it gives them the structure and guidance that they need to get through life. Whereas, you know, a more intelligent person is working in Silicon Valley or just an ordinary life isn't going to feel that same need for a divine guidance that will sort of answer their problems for them.
We are at the end of the show. Before I wrap things up, Giovanni Donato, is there anything else you'd like to add about social status?
I think it's one of several forces like the sexual market or symbols that form things like the social that I've called collectively cosmology that have to be taken into account to form a realistic picture of society. One of the things that has really been discredited at this point that you can run a society just by spreadsheets and pleasures and pains, and we're still figuring out what the hell we're going to replace that with.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Giovanni Donato for being on. It's been an excellent show.
Thank you.
And also thanks to Sam Kevorkian.
Thank you.